1979, back in the days of disco, introducing us into another episode of Conservative Casual Friday here today with your show host, Andrew Harrod. And we wanted to think about freaking out as we examine a new book, questioning whether we freaked out and given the wrong policy responses around the world and here in the United States in particular concerning the COVID-19 coronavirus. This made in China virus, or Chi-Com virus, if you want to call it that, perhaps. This new book is called The Price of Panic, How the Tyranny of Experts Turned a Pandemic into a Catastrophe. And we want to interview one of its authors, J.W. Richards, who is a professor at Catholic University at the Bush Business School there. We're trying to get him in on the show, waiting for him to log in, to call in, so we can talk to him. He is one of the authors of this book, along with William M. Briggs, who is a previous guest on Conservative Casual Friday with me about a month ago. You can listen to his conversation he had with me here at the at Conservative Casual Friday on the Global Patriot Radio, or also he's listed the posted the conversation he had, the interview he had on his own website, Statistician to the Stars. He is a statistician who has worked at places, for example, like Cornell University Medical School, as well as the third author in the trio of behind the book of The Price of Panic is Biola University biology professor Douglas Axe. And we are waiting for J.W. Richards, to call in. And we would like to discuss with him this important book, this excellent book, which I have reviewed and I'm going to be placing in review. And we're really looking forward to him to log in. We'll see if we can get him in. We're having some simply, if we could, he's hearing us here, but we want to bring him in. If we can bring him in on the studio website and have him come in and talk. It's an excellent book I must recommend, arguing that the lockdown strategies that have been so prevalent around the world here in the United States and elsewhere have not really not brought any gain to combating this virus and have brought enormous pain to the wider society, the wider globe, the economy, and all sectors of society that really are largely not affected by this virus. It targets a really primarily a select group of people, mostly elderly people, like other viruses in the past, say 65 and older. The average age of death, as the book of in the United States, as the book notes, is some 76.2 years for anyone who dies from the, why is that? We seem to be having problems here bringing him in. He's hearing me. What is wrong? I'm trying to hear. Let's see. Why is he? What is wrong? We want to bring him in. It's an excellent book, which examines the COVID-19 virus in the context of he's hearing me, but for some reason he's not able to call in or log in. Why is he being shut out? Let's see. We want to bring him in. Why is this? We're experiencing technical difficulties, my listeners. Please bear with us. We want to bring him in. The book, again, is The Price of Panic, How the Tyranny of Experts Turned a Pandemic into a Catastrophe. You can order online, for example, if you go to William Briggs's website, Statistician to the Stars. He has it listed on his website, and you can order it there. It is an excellent book. I highly recommend it. It documents with various studies and graphs the course of the virus, how it's behaved, whom it's affected and whom not, and whether lockdowns anywhere in the United States and various states or in various countries around. Oh, hey, here we have Jay Richards. We can bring him in. Jay?
Yes, can you hear me?
Oh, hey, we got you. Excellent. Well, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Let me turn. I've been listening to you the whole time.
So did you call in now or use the internet link?
You still hear me?
Yeah, I hear you. Did you call in?
Oh, great. Sorry, I logged on about five times. I could hear you, and I cannot. Actually, you couldn't hear me. I'm not sure what happened. But together,
you're using the internet link. Okay. Well, there's been some question about the internet link before. Whenever people call in, there's no problem. But there has been some delay using the internet link before. Maybe it's poor internet connection somewhere. But well, actually, we're glad to have you on the show. And indeed, it's good to talk with you. You just noted online on your Twitter account that you've now had your own personal experience with COVID-19, that you tested positive. I guess you were showing up for a recent health appointment or something, you had a cold. So describe your own experience with COVID-19.
Absolutely. I mean, when we wrote the book, of course, we were working on it in the spring and the summer. We thought, well, maybe one of us will actually get it, but none of us had even been tested. But here, I guess on Saturday or Sunday, I started feeling like I had a bit of a cold, not a huge deal. But yesterday I thought, well, you know, I even had a slight fever, which I would not normally have checked, needless to say, but I thought I'd better check. So I did a drive-through here in suburban D.C. I live in Maryland. The antigen test with the swab in the nose, and they tested it. It's a turnaround, and so it came back positive. And so assuming it's not a false positive, since I do have some symptoms, I mean, it's literally just exactly, for me, it's exactly like a cold and not any bigger deal than that. And so I've basically been doing podcast interviews and radio interviews about the book Price of Panic with an active COVID infection this whole week. So it's sort of bizarre, but I thought, okay, well, at least I'm going to get this from the inside. So the test was pretty efficient. I've now been called by the Maryland Department of Health, and they're tracking it. And so it's sort of what you would expect. I mean, I'm not in a high-risk category. Certainly my health is fine, and it's what many people that I've heard of that have it, you know, it feels very much like a cold. And some people, of course, have much worse symptoms. Some people have no symptoms. I'm on the low symptomatic side.
Well, that's interesting. So we have now a personal experience. You're speaking sort of, you know, from the horse's mouth here, or from your own experience. You're not just a bystander anymore. Well, did you, in your own life, did you follow all these precautions that people are talking about and doing, and wearing masks and cleaning and so forth?
Do basically what, you know, we're told to do because just under duress. So I honestly can't think that I have gone to a restaurant or anything like that. I did go to the doctor a week ago for my annual physical. So it's possible I caught it then, but I was wearing a surgical mask. But I also know from having done research that, you know, if you're catching it by an aerosol air, the surgical mask, which is loosely fitted, is probably not going to make any difference. You know, I generally put those on, but I certainly am not, other than my normal kind of cleanliness, I don't have anything ordinary. But the truth of the matter is I don't even really leave my house very much because I'm able to do most of my work from my computer. And so it is funny. It's sort of ironic I actually have gone to the doctor for my annual physical.
Well, thinking of all these lockdown measures, describe then the cost of these lockdown measures here in the United States and abroad. I mean, economically, other issues of, say, you know, people committing suicide. So there's a question of loss of life there.
Yeah, it's a catastrophe. I mean, the lockdowns, we estimate just the lockdown we're doing in the spring cost the economy about $1 trillion every month that they're happening. So now we have this kind of mix of lockdowns, no lockdowns. So it's easy to realize that we've cost the economy several trillion dollars just this year. This isn't from the coronavirus, but we estimate the sort of pandemic itself from the cost. We're talking about the cost of lockdowns, $1 trillion a month, 41 million new jobless claims by late May, as all of us heard, which is another way of kind of figuring this economic cost. But actual cost directly in lives, one estimate early on, we think is conservative, predicted to be about 75,000 excess deaths of despair in 2020. That is deaths from suicide and drug and alcohol overdose. Those are excess deaths of despair, so over and above what you would just sort of expect statistically. And so obviously we're going to attribute those to the lockdowns. One study estimates that about 8,000 cancer screenings were missed during that first 3 months of the lockdown. So in other words, people that have cancer that would have been caught in regular screening or during a doctor's appointment that got missed because essentially all their deaths and illnesses just sort of got de-emphasized during the height of the panic in the spring. And that's just cancer, right? So that tells you very quickly between deaths of despair and missed screenings for cancer and other deadly diseases, you could end up with the lockdowns causing as much death as actually caused by COVID-19 itself. That's just the very definition of a bad public policy response.
Well, what is now the death, looking at COVID-19 statistics, comparing, on the other hand, deaths from this virus, in your book you cite the website WorldOrMeter as a source for listing how many people have died from COVID-19. Back in June, when you were writing the book, their estimate was worldwide some 800,000 people had died from mm-hmm. COVID-19. The latest figure I checked 2 days ago on November, or I guess yesterday or the night before of November, they now list some 1.2 million COVID deaths worldwide. How does that compare with pandemics historically?
Well, and that's just, you know, all we can really do is deal with attributed numbers at this point. We think, and we know the CDC is much more careful with these numbers than WorldOrMeter is, but if you just sort of track that, this is more or less like the Hong Kong flu of 1968, which we think killed about 1 million people during the season. Of course, we're in the next season, and so you don't count these things. It's not like you count flu deaths by adding them all up. You have to take them by season. And so we think that, assuming those numbers are more or less accurate, that this is on the order of the Hong Kong flu of 1968, which was a real pandemic. Those are real deaths. But no one hardly remembers that. I mean, when people people think of 1968, they think of Woodstock and assassinations and, you know, political unrest in Vietnam. No one even remembers that there was actually a pandemic then. 10 years earlier, 1957-58, we had the so-called Asian flu, which was probably twice as deadly, probably killed about 2 million people, and it set the world a panic. In fact, most people that lived during that time probably don't even remember that. You could go back to 1917 and the Spanish flu epidemic, which was really, I mean, really a big disaster, certainly in the 20th century in terms of pandemics, maybe killed 40 million people. That's what we were told from the Imperial College London, was that the coronavirus was going to be as deadly as the Spanish flu. And so that's part of what led to panic, except that alone can explain it, because, of course, there wasn't a panic during the Spanish flu either. And so when we went to write the book, we thought, well, we got to account for the fact, just, you know, it's not just about this particular coronavirus, because historically it's fairly unexceptional. What's exceptional is this weird planet-wide social contagion in which almost every country in the world absolutely panicked and panicked so much that we shut down our economies. That never happened before.
Yeah, that's interesting. I talked with William Briggs on the interview I did about a month. I mentioned that we specifically the Hong Kong flu of the 1968-1969 season. You know, I was born in 1969. 69 was, of course, famously the year of Woodstock. You know, I mean,
right.
No one was social distancing out there in the mud. One thing I found interesting in the book is you discussed then the Spanish flu after World War One, right at the end of World War One in 1918. This virus killed anywhere between 8 million people worldwide. That the response to it was actually back then more like what we see today in Sweden in responding in the COVID to the COVID-19 virus. Discuss that a little more. What was 1918 with the Spanish flu?
Yeah, I mean, that's right. I mean, there were some towns and municipalities. We see pictures from the time in which people were wearing cloth masks and things like that. In fact, research on whether masks are effective for the general population has been done since the Spanish flu. That's how long we've been trying to nail down whether masks for the general population makes a difference or not. But the response really was much more regional. You know, people would do the kind of things that we saw in Sweden, which, you know, at least 2020, Sweden was considered to be the Wild West of COVID-19 responses. They didn't do general population-wide lockdowns. They didn't close their schools for any, you know, major length of time or anything like that. And that's the, sort of the irony. In fact, historians have not even been able to find any references that the president at the time, Woodrow Wilson, made to Spanish. Now, Wilson wasn't a good guy, and so I don't want to sort of praise him for not saying anything about it. But the point is that it didn't figure prominently.
Yeah, that's interesting. And then that brings up a question where then, for example, did this whole idea of a lockdown, I mean, has any in response to any prior disease pandemic done such a lockdown? Is this a normal practice?
No, in fact, it's unprecedented. It's actually this idea that you lock down the entire population contradicts the standard response, which standard response is quarantine, in which you isolate people you know are sick and symptomatic. And you focus your protection on people that are actually high risk. That's just the standard way in which you've responded to the past. That was the CDC policy. Even the World Health Organization a year ago issued a report saying there's no really good scientific evidence that population-wide lockdowns would help to prevent or to slow the spread of a pandemic. It emerged, ironically, we tell the story in the book, from a high school science experiment in the 2000s. A daughter of a scientist at Sandia National Labs in New Mexico created a model to test, okay, what would happen in her high school if you did lockdowns. And, well, but in a computer model, all the work is done with the assumption to plug into the model. So she assumed that it would make a difference, and lo and behold, it did. Her dad found this interesting. He and another scientist and his daughter actually co-authored a paper together in the CDC journal. It worked its way through the kind of bowels of the bureaucracy. A man named Henderson actually opposed it. He was the leading expert at the time and said, this would just destroy the economy and not work. But as these things go, it ended up kind of becoming the prevailing idea. So it became the kind of conventional wisdom. What you want to do is lock down the whole population in a pandemic. But we hadn't had a pandemic to try it yet. And so that's essentially what 2020 became. We finally had a pandemic, and so they rolled out this strategy of population lockdowns. It never had any good evidence to commend it to begin with. We now have, after the fact, actually evidence whether it worked or not. And we show in the book that no, there's absolutely no evidence that government-imposed population-wide lockdowns do anything discernible to slow the spread of a virus like this, which suggests that, you know, it's effectively all pain and no gain.
Yeah, that's interesting. That raises a fundamental question. Is this lockdown in any way hindering the disease or so forth? I mean, you have countries, for example, like Israel, or, you know, they've done lockdowns and then they'll say, okay, we've got it under control, and they'll open up again. But then all of a sudden, you know, their case rates go up and they say, oh my goodness, we got a lockdown again. So up and down, recurring lockdowns. How can this lockdown do anything to hinder the disease, or does the disease just keep spreading no matter what? It's not, I mean, this lockdown can't really eliminate the disease, right? So does it just, once you open up again, you just have, just sort of a similar spread of people?
I would think it's almost, at least looking at data, because you always find some correlation in some particular place, because, you know, the cases wax and wane. The problem with even tracking cases, though, is that it's an artifact of the number of tests that you do, unfortunately. As we redefine cases to mean positive tests sometime in the summer, well, if you do 1.5 million tests, like we're doing some days in the United States, you're going to get a lot of positive tests out of that. And then you call those cases, even if they're asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic. And before, what a case meant was somebody that was so sick that they had to go to the doctor, and then they went to the doctor to get treated. They got tested and were confirmed to have the kind of associated disease, or just effectively, okay, how many positive tests do we have? What we need to be tracking is really sort of genuine hospitalizations, deaths. That's the relevant thing. Of course, you want to make sure that you're not simply, because you're doing so much testing, simply attributing deaths to coronavirus, because everybody that shows up in a hospital gets tested. That's the difficulty. And if you actually try to pursue this objectively, look at the case curves, which we have all of those case curves and death curves for the states, individual countries. We have the dates when governments impose lockdowns. If lockdowns worked, you should expect to see the effect of the lockdowns in curves. That is, you see a signal in noise. So the curves would start bending down about 10 or 11 days after the lockdowns go into effect. I can tell you, if you, you know, we're just describing this here, but if people look in the book, there's no evidence of that. If you took the date off when the governments imposed their lockdowns, you'd not be able to guess when the lockdowns occurred just from looking at the curves of the different states and the countries. And so that's where you say the government imposed lockdowns have no discernible effect. Thing we do makes any difference. What we suspect is that the kind of voluntary things we do already, you know, if we hear there's a bad flu season, or when people heard about the coronavirus, you start kind of changing your behavior automatically based upon your knowledge of your particular circumstance. We suspect that alone, just the information and then kind of voluntary behavior, probably does about all the good that can be done. And then when you start locking down populations, you have all of these contrary effects. I mean, locking people up, for instance, in houses is just a really bad idea when you're dealing with the respiratory virus. And so we suspect the lockdowns themselves have these weird kind of counterintuitive effects, so that they neutralize whatever positive effects they might otherwise have.
Yeah, I guess if you didn't have the lockdowns, then maybe, if you have like a family unit, maybe then, an older person in the family unit could sort of self-isolate, and the other people would limit the exposure of that person and go outside much more.
Exactly. Yeah, because, right, if you have somebody that's high risk in your house, a lockdown just basically means that you're locked down with them. But the reason that, say, the flu season has the curve that it does every year is because of weather. And so when it gets cold, we're in the northern hemisphere, it gets generally cold. People end up more inside air. You sort of transfer it around much more easily. And so that's why it spreads. The reason we think we had this kind of double spike in the case of COVID-19, where it had a big one in the spring in the northern part of the country. And then you had places like Arizona and Texas and Florida that seemed to spike later, is because it came online. The coronavirus came online at a different time from the flu. The flu normally kind of hits the population in the fall, and so we sort of have the same kind of curve. What happened is that effectively it really didn't start working its way through the population until maybe December or January. And so you had the kind of normal flu-like curve in the spring or in the winter that sort of dissipated in the spring. But then you think about, okay, so what do people do in the deep south, in Arizona and Florida? Well, what happens is that they're outside in the spring, and then they start going inside in the summer. If you live in Florida, you're not spending all day outside. You're going back inside to dry air-conditioned air. And so they effectively experienced it a little later, but it was for the same basic reason, that kind of inside-outside dynamic. Nevertheless, Florida Governor DeSantis responded much more rationally, much more in a science-based way, by focusing on nursing homes and the elderly and not just keeping the whole population locked down. And so people may remember he was, you know, the media all said that he was going to kill millions of people in Florida. Well, it didn't happen. And it turns out Florida in many ways is the kind of model way that a state should respond. The nice thing is that we had several different states respond in different ways. And so from a kind of a data perspective, at least we have a way of comparing the effects of different responses.
Yeah, well, that gets back to the whole idea of Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis talking about how states are the laboratory of policies in a federal system like the United States, that states can try out different ideas. Well, how is Florida doing? I mean, they ended their lockdown, I guess, about a month ago or 2 months ago. How are they doing now? I guess they don't wear any masks or anything down in Florida now.
Well, and so it's, again, it's a lot of voluntary things, and different cities do different things. They had a kind of a temporary semi-lockdown early on in the spring. Governor DeSantis, a lot of the public health sort of resources in Florida have been focused for months, actually, on nursing homes and on retirement facilities, and they're doing fine. I mean, I would expect that we're going to have an increase here in the fall, just like we're going to have, you would have an increase if we were dealing with the flu. That's just what happens with respiratory viruses. And so we should not say, oh, no, we've got, you know, hospitalizations are increasing. The same thing happens with the flu. We do not shut the society down because the flu. But then people say, well, don't trivialize it. No, the flu is not trivial. The flu almost killed me in 2016. It's just that we have to sort of decide, okay, what response is appropriate to risk? If we were doing a ticker across of our screens and news feeds of every person that was hospitalized with the flu, we would have keep ourselves in a 24/7 panic mode. Well, that's what we've done with the coronavirus. And the problem is that it's completely out of keeping with the real risk of the virus. That original model predicted it was a 3.4% infection fatality rate, again, assuming it was going to be like the Spanish flu. Well, that's just wrong. Even in places like New York, we now know it's below 0.5%, so less than 1%. And in fact, for the world, the infection fatality rate is almost certainly not higher than 0.26%. So more than an order of magnitude less deadly than the computer model predicted, and far less deadly, I should add, than the average American thinks. A poll in July, COVID tracking poll, asked Americans to guess what percentage of the population had died of COVID-19. So not what percentage of people who were infected died, but what percentage of the whole population died. And the average guess was 9%. Well, the real infection fatality rate is about 0.06%. So what that means is the average American thinks the coronavirus is 150 times more deadly than it actually is. Well, that's the panic. And that was almost entirely induced by media and social media, which whose job would presumably have been to give us an accurate understanding of the dangers, and instead they persuaded us that it was 150 times more deadly than it really is.
Yeah, and again, looking at the breakdown of those figures, it's clearly for older people who are at threat. I believe that the infection fatality rate for people over 65 is like half a percentage point or something, Whereas for someone like under 50, it's, you know, almost minuscule, almost infinitesimal. Like I guess in the age group for people who are like 50, it's like 5 in 10,000 people who are infected die.
Yeah, it's more or less like the flu for people that are not in the high risk category, that are in kind of the middle age range. You're basically, you know, your risk assessment should be about the same as it would be for the flu. If you're a child, you're actually much more at risk of dying of the flu than COVID-19. I mean, dying of COVID-19 is like, it's a 1 in a million thing if you're a child, a kind of school-age child. It really, it's about 1,000 times more deadly for people over 70 than it is for people under 20. And so this idea that we should just treat the entire population as a homogenous block makes absolutely no sense, especially when the people that are most at risk are the people least likely to be in the workforce and least likely to be in school.
Yeah, and I guess for Florida, that's a particularly relevant fact. You know, if you compare New York, where people have noted there have been, you know, Governor Cuomo, he emptied out, he was afraid of hospital bed shortage, emptied out hospital beds, sent them into nursing homes, and then that just let it go wild, and you had a high death rate. Whereas you have also, of course, a large elderly population in the retirement state of Florida. And yet, as you're indicating and others, you know, they've done really well. They've had much lower death rates than New York.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think that New York is and New Jersey are just a catastrophe, absolutely, any way you count it. But even there, if you actually look, the vast majority of deaths are right around kind of the ground zero of Manhattan and working its way out. So New York didn't have a bad problem sort of out in upstate New York. It was really right there where you had extremely high population density and then a just singularly insane policy in which people in nursing homes would go to the hospital for a procedure. They would catch COVID-19, and then they were forced to go back into the nursing homes. I mean, you could not have come up with a policy more designed to kill people if you had tried. Now, I don't think that was the design. I think it was an unintended consequence, but it was nevertheless absolutely a catastrophe. And so that's why I think you had such severe deaths in New York and New Jersey, and you didn't have that in Florida because Governor DeSantis, what he did is he didn't just listen to whoever the random public health official was that he happened to inherit. He interviewed scientists and consulted with scientists and researchers from Europe who were on the front lines, who quickly told him, look, this is much more dangerous for elderly people with health problems than it is for everyone else. And then he crafted a policy accordingly. I mean, that's the best you can do. Look at the best evidence you have available. And then craft your policy.
Yeah, I mean, of course, you know, Italy, which is often seen as sort of one of the hotspots, ground zero of the COVID-19 virus in Europe. I mean, there you have a particularly elderly population. So that was always considered a factor, a major factor. So, you know, today, this morning, I mentioned to an acquaintance that I was going to do this radio show today, and we got into discussing COVID-19. And, you know, he was sort of taking the more alternate pro-lockdown position. He's perhaps more politically liberal than I am, and more in line, say, with the Democratic Party. But he mentioned a case like he had some niece who had given birth to a baby, and apparently somehow the baby suffered from COVID-19 and died, or I forget how. You know, what would you say to such a person like him? He was really saying, no, we need these lockdowns. We need to preserve the life of a person like that.
The argument's based on the assumptions that lockdowns actually preserve people's lives, but every response has a cost. And so the argument that, well, you know, this is what Governor Cuomo said, you know, if I save one life, it will have been worth it. That's this kind of basic fallacy that treats the response as if it's a one-sided risk. In other words, it implies that the only danger is that someone will die of COVID-19. But of course, that's not the only danger. That's why we ended up with 80,000 missed cancer screening. It's why we're going to end up with 75,000 deaths of despair, because the response itself carries risk. And so what you want rationally is a response that bears has the lowest cost and the greatest benefit. And that's absolutely not what a lockdown is. What a lockdown does is it imposes enormous costs. It fails to focus on the real danger. And as we show in the book, there's no evidence that it actually helps people. As I said, the argument's not that the coronavirus is not dangerous to anyone or that nobody can die from it. That'd be an absurd argument. It's that our response to it ends up killing more people than the coronavirus itself, and the response doesn't work. It's almost as if people say, well, it doesn't matter if it works or not. We just have to do something. That ignores the fact that there are lots of responses that are deadly. The argument was never that, well, this will be expensive in terms of dollars to lock things down, but it's totally worth it if it saves a life. No, the argument has always been, does the response save more lives than it kills? That's the real question. And we're convinced that lockdowns that lock shut down schools, shut down businesses, and completely sort of sever people's normal human interactions, it is a very, very blunt instrument. It's sort of like cutting off your head to try to get rid of a bad headache. It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, so I mean, looking at your analysis, I mean, you've listed, say, an estimated 75,000 suicides in the United States, extra suicides, and perhaps some 80,000 people dead because of mixed cancer screenings. So about, 155,000 there. And so what is our casualty rate now for COVID-19 in the United States by comparison?
Well, I mean, so there are about 200,000 or over 200,000 people that are associated with COVID-19. But of course, the CDC points out that doesn't mean everyone, that's 200,000 people directly killed by COVID-19. There's a difference between dying with COVID-19 or with the coronavirus and dying from it. And so dying with it is a much, much larger percentage. But even if you treated that entire number as actual deaths exclusively from COVID-19, it doesn't take long before the response itself kills as many people as are attributed. Now, I'd say the argument would be that, yes, but it would have been so much worse if we had not locked down. Remember that projection of 2.2 million people dying if we didn't lock down. The problem is there's absolutely no evidence that that's true. The 2.2 million number wasn't based on evidence. It was based upon an assumption about the infection fatality rate that was plugged into the predictive model. And we know that infection fatality rate was wrong. And so you can't assume that, well, okay, yeah, maybe the lockdowns had severe costs, but we saved millions of lives. No, we didn't. There's absolutely no reason. There's no evidence that we saved millions of lives. We show that the lockdowns there's no signature of the effect of the lockdowns in the actual case curves in the different states. And there's plenty of countries that did not lock down that didn't have millions of people die. I mean, it's not as if every country has responded the same way. Nobody really wants to talk about what happened in Taiwan or Japan or Vietnam or many other countries, which didn't manage to devastate their economies and didn't have it as bad. Now, I wouldn't say I think we're comparing apples and oranges when we compare some of these East Asian countries to the United States. I suspect that for whatever reason, the populations had more of a pre-existing immunity. Nevertheless, this idea that lockdowns automatically save lots of lives, it's not based on any actual evidence.
Yeah, and you note in the book, I mean, there's this whole question of dying with and dying from COVID-19, the whole issue of comorbidities, as it's called. But, we have these elderly people that, they're probably on the brink of death, like William Briggs in our last conversation discussed Ben Carson, who had stage 4 cancer, but then got COVID-19, and his death was attributed to COVID-19. But you noted
Herman Cain, probably, right?
Herman Cain, I'm sorry.
Not Ben Carson. No, don't tell me.
No, Herman Cain, the man with 999 tax rate and Godfather Pizza, not Ben Carson.
Exactly. That's right. But that's a good example. Yeah. Is that if you look at the average, I mean, we all have there's an average life expectancy. We're all mortal and we die. And so what you want to look at to see, okay, how deadly is something is say, okay, what's the average age of death associated with this thing compared to the average life expectancy? And if you do that in the United States, what you discover is the average age of death is surprisingly close to the average life expectancy. And so what that means is it's probably taking, weeks or months. You could call these kind of life months or life years. It's generally not killing people when they're 25 years old. Now, the point's not that your life isn't worth much when you're old. The point is that it's much more tragic to lose a month, to lose 30 years of your life than to lose a month of your life. And that's absolutely crucial for public health response, is if something primarily contributes to death of people that are likely to die of something sometime in the next year, right? That is just a different public health crisis than one that's just kind of indiscriminately wiping people out. Well, we sort of responded in terms of our fear as if it's indiscriminately wiping people out. And also we responded in a way that was not, did not have good evidence to show that it would even make any difference. So there's both the panic and then the policy that we implemented in as a result of the panic. And both of those, we think, are things that we need to learn lessons from.
Yeah, that's an interesting concept. The book brings out of life years that, life expectancy in the United States, I believe, is like 73 years now. We're talking about an age of death of about 76.2 from COVID-19 average age. That's even longer than life than the average life expectancy. Whereas these people committing suicide, say, you know, they're in their youth, you know, they're or their middle age or so. So they're really losing. These are people really who could survive had they not suffered from despair.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and this is why we do. You know, it's hard to just sort of summarize in a little conversation the calculations of life years, but there's a fairly well-established way in which economists calculate essentially what a life is worth. We're not literally estimating how much someone's life is worth. What we're doing is that economists calculate, okay, how much are we willing to spend to spare ourselves to save a life year in terms of insurance and various inconveniences? Because everything we do has bears some risk, but we're also willing to spend a certain amount to kind of protect ourselves from danger. And so that's how we're able to calculate, okay, so how much is a life year? What does it cost in the United States? And then you can actually do a calculation to figure out economically if a public health response makes sense. And unfortunately, our public health response is just absolutely a catastrophe. And we have to handle that carefully because inevitably when you talk about these things, people think that you're either saying how much someone's life is worth or you're saying that the older you are, the less valuable your life is. And that's absolutely not the point.
Yeah, and speaking of these models, we've discussed here this Imperial College London model that, you know, as we indicated, you know, it compared this COVID-19 to the Spanish flu and this infection fatality rate of 3.4%. You mentioned the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation from the University of Washington in Seattle. That was another important model. Have such models in the past about pandemics or other disasters typically gone so unquestioned?
Well, they do. And in fact, we talked about the Imperial College model led by a guy named Neil Ferguson ended up in the news because he advised lockdowns, but then his mistress was traveling across London by tube during the lockdowns to visit him. So he ended up losing his position. But Ferguson has a kind of basically uninterrupted record of completely disastrous predictions for things like this. And we go into it in the book. Over the last 20 years, made all sorts of bogus predictions using predictive models about different things, whether it's the swine flu or the avian flu, or whatever it was. He's always wrong on these things. He's always wrong by many, many, many orders of magnitude on his predictions, but he never suffers. So frustrating about it. And so from the very beginning with extreme skepticism, we didn't really know what the details a month before they kind of released details of the code, and they spent a month fixing it up. Actually, it turns out it was completely buggy, so that when they finally released a group of engineers at Microsoft looked at it, and this one guy said, you know, it's the model a buggy mess that looked more like a bowl of angel hair pasta than a finely tuned piece of programming. I mean, it was based in language Fortran. It was a complete mess. It ran different. It sort of had different results every time you ran it. But the kind of key point is that a model is only ever as good as the assumptions that are plugged in. It just basically tells you what you told it to say. So unless the model has been tested against the actual evidence, there's no reason in the world to trust it. It's just somebody's complex argument. But we unfortunately trusted it because the Director General of the World Health Organization glommed onto it. Dr. Anthony Fauci glommed onto it. Used the numbers in his advice to President Trump. President Trump got that 2.2 million number from Fauci, and Fauci got it from the Imperial College Boston model. And yet we're still, as you can see, even today, there'll be stories here from the IHME at the University of Washington or Imperial College about what's going to happen in the fall, right? How do they know what's going to happen in the fall? Do they have a crystal ball? Well, no, what they're doing is they're doing these same models from the same people. And so it's able to learn lessons, or at least the media is unable to learn lessons and to be a little bit more modest of trusting these things. It's the thing that started the problem. And fortunately, rather than say, okay, we don't want to hear your stupid models, we want to look at the evidence. Unfortunately, models provide sensational news stories, and so it will always have a market.
Yeah, and what about the University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation? How is that model? How well has that model stood up?
Well, it does better, but the reason is because, of course, they adjust the model based on new data. The same thing tends to happen with the climate models, is that the more data you have, the better you can tune the model. And so if you notice with these models over time, they always match past events better. And that's because they've been effectively retrofitted to fit past evidence. And what you want in a model is develop a model that it predicts or retrodicts the evidence that you already have. And then you test it going forward. And then if it turns out that it predicts it matches what actually happens, say, okay, now we have more and more reason to trust this model. But at the moment, that's not what we've had. We just have a model that gets better because it keeps getting updated. The IHME model from the very beginning, they did a better job. I think they're less ridiculous, but also part of it is that the error bars were so dramatic that it couldn't help but be accurate. You know, if you give yourself generous enough error bars, so if I say I'm going to die sometime between next tomorrow and 2025, that's my error bar. Well, you know, I've got about 100% chance of being correct. And so very often the IHME model just was very generous error bars. The problem is the media don't report it that way. They take the extreme part of the prediction and they'll focus on that number. They'll focus on the sensational number rather than telling you, well, there's a 25% chance that deaths will be between 1 and 1 million, right? That's boring news. And so the kind of nuances you might actually get with the researchers almost always lopped off when you get the headlines.
Well, thinking then here in the United States, we've looked at these other models, and you mentioned Anthony Fauci, who's head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, if I have that correct. William Briggs, your co-author, has referred to him as Frauducci is his name. How has he done in this epidemic advising Donald Trump and the wider government?
Well, I think Dr. Fauci, I treat him as well-meaning, but I think he should have resigned once it was clear that the evidence he gave the president was flawed. The evidence he gave him, President Trump describes it. On April the 8th, he said two very smart people came into his room, in his office, and said, Mr. President, 2.2 million Americans are going to die unless we shut the country down. And so I felt like we really had to advise that. We know that we know who both people are. We were able to figure out that one of those people was Anthony Fauci. Once it was clear that it was not true, especially once it became clear that the numbers were based on a flawed model, and then the real data about the lockdowns became clear, I think Dr. Fauci should at least have admitted it, and an honorable thing to have done would have been to resign. But he's not suffered anything. In fact, he's lionized by the media, who's held almost immediately as kind of an infallible oracle of science. So, to be a public health official in government in the ballot of the administrative state, it doesn't mean that you somehow won the gold medal of scientific intelligence. There were scientists from the very beginning and in reputable places that said the lockdowns were a bad idea. And he's been treated as if his voice is the thing that sort of tells us what science says. And of course, she has on the sides of every controversial issue. He was early saying there's no human-to-human transmission, and he was telling us it was silly to wear masks. Now he's telling us we absolutely have to wear a mask. Now, part of that is the data itself changed, but I do blame him for gullibly believing the Imperial College London model and then advising them. That's just the very definition of bad advice. There shouldn't be consequences for that.
Well, you mentioned then masks, this has come up in the conversation before that. Do these masks work? I mean, the book discusses, you know, you know, you just go out and buy some cloth mask, or maybe someone, you know, wears a bandana around your face, around their face. But, you know, does that stop any sort of disease? Has that ever stopped any sort of disease in the past?
Well, there's no evidence at all that these cloth masks or cloth coverings make any difference. In fact, there's even some evidence that it might help aerosolize things, whereas you know, otherwise you might just sneeze and it'd be a glob of spit. Actually, it kind of helps disperse, like a sort of like a sifter. And so wearing these cloth masks is meaningless. The surgical masks are designed to basically block, again, sort of particulate matter and spit from coming out of your mouth and nose and to protect the environment. They're not designed to protect you from the environment. Besides which, they are open on the side. So if the virus is floating in an aerosol, it's just going to go right through or right around it. An N95 mask without a valve, clean, and is properly fitted to an unmaskered face probably will help, as long as you do that and you constantly fit it. But of course, that's why the advice was that it probably doesn't make sense for non-healthcare providers to do this. Just, you got to get so many things right. You got to have the right respirator. It has to be properly fitted. It has to be clean. You have to know how to wear it or it makes a difference. But even an N95 mask, if it's not properly fitted, the air just goes right around the side of it because it's hard to pull air through the filter. And so you've got the same lung capacity either way. And so if you're wearing one of those in a highly, highly infected air, it's not going to do you much good. And so this is a problem. And there's just so many ifs involved that, yeah, ideally you might be able to reduce the risk of transmission or catching something with a respirator. But most of what we're actually doing right now is essentially hygiene theater.
Yeah, that idea of hygiene theater. I mean, I guess I would think of you know, dealing often coming from a background of studying security issues. You know, I don't know how such a mask would be any better for a virus than it would be, say, against, you know, chemical warfare on the battlefield, right? I mean, you know, we have,
yeah.
I mean, how's or biological warfare on the battlefield? You know, I've never heard of, you know, any such cloth mask, you know, stopping a chemical or biological agent, although I guess maybe in World War One in the early days with mustard gas, you know, the troops would put cloth around their faces and urinate on it, and that actually apparently had some effect when the troops initially in World War One did not have any gas masks for this new German weapon. But yeah, I don't really understand how that's going to work. Well, looking at Sweden, you know, this is obviously the oft-discussed case around the world that, you know, as you've noted, they didn't do this whole lockdown policy. They did a more moderate response. There's been some press reports from them coming that, you know, they're sort of restricting now alcohol sales or going to the bars there somewhat because they've had to increase the number of cases. How is the Swedish model of response working out now? Are they failing or are they continuing to succeed?
No, I don't think they're failing. In fact, I mean, there may be some isolated because, I mean, Sweden is, you know, we think of it as a unified country. Actually, it's not a big country, but local municipalities and areas are able to do their own thing. And so describing Sweden is always hard. The one thing we can say is they did not have a big government centralized lockdown. They have not imposed masks upon people. They're more or less back to normal. They did very little damage to their economy, so they fared much better economically than everyone else. They had higher per capita deaths than their neighboring Norway, which had the big lockdown, but they had much lower than their neighboring Belgium, which had draconian lockdowns and yet had more deaths. We think that the Swedish response is basically right, one exception. They did not focus enough attention early on the dangers to the elderly in nursing homes. They've got a large population that lives sort of congregated together in nursing homes and retirement facilities. And they didn't realize early on just how high risk people were. And so if you look, a lot of the deaths in Sweden are from that. And so we honestly think Swedish response plus focused protection on the high-risk population probably the very best thing. In other words, of the live alternatives in the real world, the policy that will have the fewest costs and consequences, greatest benefit is Sweden plus focused protection on nursing homes.
Well, so now are we William Briggs at his website, Statistician to the Stars, has suggested that the death rate in Sweden in particular and also around the world from COVID-19 is now declining. So are we turning the corner on this disease?
Well, it's definitely been declining since the peaks in spring. We will probably be an increase now as we get back into what we used to call the flu season. It's not going to go back up, but in terms of being the real pandemic, what we've got now is a case pandemic in which we're doing massive amounts of testing. We went in the winter from zero tests to now doing well over a million tests every single day in the United States. And so people say, well, we've got far more cases here. Well, you know, in Sub-Saharan Africa, they're not running tests. So by definition, they end up not having cases. And so you can't both say it's great that we do lots of testing and complain that we have lots of positive cases. What we want to really want to keep an eye on, okay, look, what's the death rate actually happening? And I absolutely don't expect it to be anything like it was last year, in part because I think it's waning. More and more people have some kind of immunity. And also, we just know better how to treat it. We're not sticking people immediately on respirators and things like that. Early on, you know, we were still trying to figure out, okay, what's the best way to respond to this? And so, no reason that they should not have a repeat that we had in 2020 and 2021. Honestly, that's why we wrote the book. We thought we can't stop what's already happened, but we at least want to make the case that we don't want to have another lockdown.
Well, maybe in closing out, you've got to run to a 1 p.m. conversation here. What do you think this whole experience says about other issues in public policy like climate change, you know, about modeling that, and we've got to take massive measures to respond? Does this give us a sobering sort of lesson experience here to think of that?
It does. I mean, I think that we need to create far more space between untested predictive modeling and public policy. These models should not have the power to be able to shut down the world. It's not science to be using predictive modeling that hasn't been tested. It's pure speculation. These essentially become tools for social control. So we need to be much, much more skeptical about that. I think we also need to become more acutely aware of the use of public health emergencies in order to control populations. Because it'd be one thing if we're told to lock down and go to work for our own good. We would all have objected to that. But if we're told that we need to do it for our fellow human beings and for our vulnerable Americans, we're much more likely to comply. So I think people, you know, that would like to exercise control over us, they notice that. They're going to notice that this is a really good way to get the American public to comply. And so I think we need to become more educated along those lines.
All right, then, important lessons for us to remember. J.W. Richards, thank you very much for joining us here on Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Hare, to discuss the price of panic, how the tyranny of experts turned a pandemic into a catastrophe. You can get that online at, for example, William Briggs' Statistician to the Stars website. Jay Richards, thank you very much for joining us. And for our listeners, join in next Friday for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday.